Church, thank you, Tommy and the Zoe group. I don't know where you're sitting this morning, but you did a beautiful job out there. I tell you what, it's been a great Sunday. If you happen to miss our Bible class hour, then we need you to fill out a slip as to why on your way out. Just kidding. No, if you happen to miss our Bible class hour, we had a special guest speaker here with us, Caleb McCall, and he presented his Be the Bush Ministries that's beginning here at the beginning of September. And it is an in-house program for men who are struggling with addiction, and they're going to have, I believe, up to, they're going to have two houses that can hold up to seven residents at a time, plus a live-in counselor, someone to oversee their recovery and get them into routine and get them into work habits and work with them. So very thankful for that. And our congregation as a whole, our elders have decided this is something we want to sponsor. And so we're going to do that. But they're also looking for, Caleb's looking for individual sponsors, if that's something you believe is important. I didn't realize that this city, Manchester, is number seven in the state in drug crimes and convictions, and so that's not a good statistic, and it shows a desperate need for our community. So anyway, he was here and shared that with us. Very thankful for that. I hope that you will be in contact with them if that's a ministry you would like to support. It has been an exciting week for me as well. Some of you know that it was Rebecca and I. We had our 22nd anniversary this last week, and so we had gotten away. We on the way earlier, a couple weeks earlier, we spent the night in Knoxville and just had a good night out and everything. But the day of rolled around, and it was on a Friday. We didn't have anything planned for Friday night. I thought we should go to a nice dinner, even though we've technically already celebrated our anniversary. We can go somewhere nice, and so we went to one of our favorite restaurants in Murfreesboro, had a great dinner, and then I dropped her off for 15 minutes of fun at Target, and anyway, so we're on our way home, and we're driving along, having a good conversation. We kept hearing this noise intermittently. Every once in a while, you'd hear this something. It sounded like it was flapping in the breeze against the side of the car. Looked out, didn't see anything. Then all of a sudden, I said, "Do you hear that?" There it is again. Rebecca goes, "Well, I heard it. It fell away." I said, "Oh, don't know what that was, you know. Maybe a branch got caught up underneath the car. I don't know how that would have happened." But shortly thereafter, we started hearing a much louder noise, and it was my rear tire going flat on interstate about 10 or so at night. And so we managed to make it to an exit and got off the exit, pulled into a Shell gas station there, kind of one of those exits with nothing else around. And we got there, and I can change a tire. I'm not completely emasculated. I can change a tire. And so I got everything out and got this terrible, terrible jack out. And I finally got my tire off. But I could not get my wheel high enough to get my rear spare remounted. For whatever reason, my wheel was not getting up high enough. I had the jack all the way up, as close to the tire as I could get it, and could not get it high enough to get the spare on. I thought, this is, you know, something's broken back here. And I don't even know enough to know what is broken, but I can't drive this, you know, obviously. So Rebecca called a tow truck, and I'm covered in grime. I've been wrestling around with this thing. And I am not certain who designed the tire changing operations for Mercury Mariner around this time, but they're going to answer to God for it. Because this was a terrible, terrible system. The jack is right out of the seven rings of hell, the Dante's Inferno. I'm sure the jack, or the nine levels of hell. Anyway, it was all terrible. And so I go in, I was like, look, I give up. I have been at this an hour and done everything I know to do and can't do it. So I went inside to get cleaned up, covered in grease and grime and, you know, brake dust, all that stuff. And I come back out, and there's a Hiller van that looked like it might be abducting my wife beside, parked up by my vehicle in the kind of in the middle of nowhere on the Shell parking lot. I get up, and it's a guy, and He's breaking my game. I have worked hard for my 22nd anniversary. My wife has been giving me eyes all night long. And this guy comes along and steals my thunder. Pretty sure my wife asked him out after he finished getting my tire back on my van. He had a couple of extra tools that I did not have and was able to get my rear spare on there. And I have dropped it off. If you are here, Baxter White, you are an extra vehicle on your lot today. You can sell it or fix it as you choose. So anyway, it was a great thing, but it reminded me, I was just thinking, you know, we were very fortunate. We talked about this. Just very fortunate that it happened where it did. You know, we were able to get off of the interstate and into a safe place to change tire, because I was thinking about changing a tire 10 o'clock at night on the side of a dark interstate, and that just is not fun at all. I have changed a tire in the dark on the side of the interstate, but I was a lot younger and didn't realize just how dangerous that was at the time. It didn't really bother me. Now I was really aware of the dangers, and it's, truth be told, look, we face dangers. We all face dangers nearly every single day, right? There are dangers all around us. If you get onto I-24, you are taking your life in your hands every time you do it. I mean, there are dangers that we're aware of. There are dangers that we're unaware of. Every morning you get up and you take your life in your hands. I was acutely aware of this when I first moved to Nashville. I moved to Nashville from a town that was made Manchester look like a metropolis. A town not much bigger than Viola, I learned last night. Just a little bitty town. I moved to Nashville, and I remember going to the hospitals or taking my kids to school was a 30-minute exercise in terror. I mean, sweaty palms, you know, it was just get there and pray I make it there in one piece. And after I lived there for a few months, I could pull into a parking garage without being conscious of every step along the way, right? You just get used to the drive, and you just sort of get there. And it may be like that for you. You just become immune to how you've gotten there. Some of you work at really dangerous jobs. You know, you may work with a piece of heavy machinery, you may work in a plant, or you may be working in education, all of which has the possibility of one misstep, you could lose an arm or a leg or even your life, especially if you work with middle school students. And so even in the relatively safety of your home, right, you think your home is a safe place, but we're surrounded by dangers that could paralyze us with fear if we really thought about all of those things. You know, you lean the wrong way when you're cleaning your gutter, and then you're on your back 10 feet off the ground, right? You forget to wash the counter when you're preparing that chicken dinner, and then the what you've made for your family this afternoon gets everybody sick, right? Believe it or not, there are all sorts of dangers that you can, you know, there's showers and tubs and toasters and microwaves, all of which are potentially dangerous, and they're around us all the time. We're surrounded by some very real physical dangers. We just kind of become immune to it because we're just used to it. And I submit to you that there are some really very serious spiritual dangers that are around us as well. Things that threaten our relationship with God, our relationship with His church, our relationship through Jesus Christ, our relationship with the Holy Spirit. There are some very real dangers to those relationships that exist, and you're around them all the time, so you just sort of get immune to them. And I think one of those dangers, one of the dangers we're just so used to we'd ignore it, is worship. I think worship is a very real danger, because unlike a lot of those other instances, the physical dangers we're thinking about, worship is dangerous not because of what's going on outside of us or things that can go wrong out there, but what can go wrong in here. Like, the dangers are internal. The dangers are inherent in being human when we approach the throne of God. John Bikima tells a story about one of his times as a kid, and he said Play-Doh was one of his favorite toys, and on one occasion after receiving a brand new pack, his aunt gives him a brand new pack of Play-Doh, and she said, hey, we should make cookies with the Play-Doh. He goes, like, that sounds like a great idea. I think Play-Doh smells delicious, right? And so he said, we made the dough into a couple dozen cookies, and they were bright, and they were colorful, and then we put them in there, and she said, let's bake them. And I thought, oh, that sounds fantastic. And so, he said, I've never turned down a cookie. And so they put these Play-Doh cookies in the oven. When they came out, he said, how long before we can eat them? And she said, These are not for eating. These are just for, you know, decoration. These are just to look at. And he said, I thought it was a terrible ripoff. Not only did I not get cookies, I didn't even get to play with the Play-Doh anymore. But I learned a really valuable lesson that day. That no matter how good the cookies look, appearance is not as important than ingredients. Appearance is not as important as the ingredients. Whenever we move into worship, sometimes we can become so fixated on the appearance. Does it look right? Does it, you know, act right? Does it walk and talk right? Right? That we run a very real danger of a sort of insincere worship. We run the risk of coming to God in disguise. It can be tempting to come to God wearing a mask, appearing like what we think we ought to look like when we come to worship, right? We come here in our collared shirt. Ray got up here today, made me look really bad. He's got a white pressed shirt and a tie. Appreciate that, Ray. We can come to God thinking, this is how I ought to look. Got on my Sunday clothes, all sparkly clean. I took a shower on Saturday night. I got my family all together. Things are just perfect. We run the risk of saying, God, this is who I am when we worship. Rather than coming to God and saying, look, I am broken, I am desperate, I am hungry, I am needy, and that's why I've come to worship. So this morning, I want us to think about a couple of things, because a lot of churches spend a lot of time debating what worship should look like on the outside. Our traditional gospel songs, and by traditional I mean over the last 200 years, not the last 2,000. Our traditional gospel songs that we sang for a good while, are they inherently better than new praise songs? Or maybe we should go back to the really old songs where there's a call and response and we just chant kind of without tone, right? And we do it straight out of the Psalms. Maybe that's what our songs ever should be like, because that's what it was like for a long time. Maybe we should go back to that. Or maybe we need a better PowerPoint projector. Or should we even have a PowerPoint projector? Can you really worship in jeans and a t-shirt and flip-flops? Can you really worship with musical instruments? Can you have women who stand up sometimes and face the crowd rather than stand up and face forward? And maybe could you have, I don't know, there's all these different debates, right? Everything turns into a debate. But the real question, at least from our vantage point this morning, is what's going on the inside? We've argued about the outsides, and then believe me, there are arguments enough to go around about what goes on the outside. Well, we want to talk about this morning what's going on the inside, because true worship comes to us from the inside out. And I think I left my little clicker down there. Yeah, how did that get over there? Did I put that there? Did I come over here? Was the communion completely non-alcoholic this morning? Because I don't remember coming over here at all. Anyway. Oh, thank you. Appreciate that. All right. So here's what Jesus declares in John chapter 4, verse 23. A time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is actively seeking people to worship Him. Now, worship is our human response to this divine initiative. God calls and we respond. Remember the nature of God. Our God is one who seeks. Our God is a seeker, not the other way around. We did not seek God out. I don't care how great you think you are or how great you think you were. You did not seek out God. He sought out you. You were the sought. He was the seeker, and He is seeking people whom He may call into this relationship, into this worship, and this relationship. It was God who sought out Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden after they sinned, and God knew it, right? It was God the incarnate who drew all men to Himself when He was lifted up high on the cross. Our Bibles are filled with example after example of the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of Peter and Paul and John, and the God of you and me and the Forest Mill congregation. This God who sees His prodigal son afar off and goes running to Him because He's been waiting for Him and looking for Him and seeking Him out. Worship is the response to that overture of love from the heart of the Father. And it is kindled in us when His Spirit touches our spirit. That's what worship is. And we can use all the right methods. We can use all the right techniques. We can sing the best songs. We can pray the best prayers. But we have not worshiped God at all until His Spirit touches our spirit. And that's when worship begins. Right? Singing praises, praying, partaking the Lord's Supper, reflecting on the Son, all of those things can lead to worship. But worship is more than any of them. We can do every single one of those things exactly right and never worship. When we take an honest look at ourselves, at our distraction, at our self-absorption, are you busy on your phone already? Like, I hadn't even gotten to the boring part yet. Right? Are you already thinking about your Sunday lunch? Got something in the crock pot or Los Maracas calling your name? When we take an honest look at ourselves and what's going on in our minds, what's going on in our hearts, and we know. Imagine how you'd feel if you woke up this morning. Just imagine. And your lovely spouse, male or female, and your children, if you got children, but they decided, oh, we just want to do something really nice here. And they prepared a breakfast in bed for you, and they fix like your favorite, very favorite things. They bring them to you on a silver platter, and they set them down on your lap. They're still warm and fresh, and they say to you with a straight face, look, we didn't really want to do this, but you said this is what you liked. And everyone sort of expects us to do it, so eat it and like it. We'd love to stay and chat, but we're really hungry, so we're headed to the Waffle House. Let's go, kids. Our hour's up. Wouldn't you be pleased? Wouldn't that be awesome? I mean, you're getting exactly what you wanted, right? Your loving family has prepared a beautiful meal of your favorite things, so you're getting exactly what you want. Aren't you pleased with that? Well, of course not, right? Your favorite meal was not your favorite meal. Because what you really wanted was to be loved and appreciated by your family. That's what you really wanted. Your favorite meal was just a way of expressing that. You wished they'd expressed that. But they didn't. They just performed the actions, right? And church, there have been times when we have been so concerned with the question of correct form that we forget the function of worship. Connecting our spirit with the Spirit of God. We can get the form exactly right. We can go out and we can get an old car, and we can get all the right original parts, we can get it fixed up, and we can get it looking pristine and brand new and beautiful, but if we do not drive that car, it is not worth the rubber of the tires, right? It has a function. It was meant to be driven. We've got all the parts of the car here, all the parts of worship here. But if we don't drive, if we don't go anywhere, it's not doing anything. It was meant to be driven. It was meant to be connecting our spirit to God. And we have a tendency to do that. We have a tendency to make the forms. And I mean by that the prayer, the singing, giving, Lord's Supper, sermon, teaching, we have a tendency to take those forms and say, these are the most important things. This is really what's primary about it, encountering the living God and seeing His glory and reflecting it back. And in fact, He's wanting that connection with us. The forms are not the worship. The forms of worship are not the worship themselves. They can only like lead a horse to water. They can't make us drink. They are tools God uses to bring us into His presence. They are not magical incantations like Harry Potter. Right? So we cannot hide behind the forms. We can't come to God with a heart that's distracted by a million other things and say, look, as long as I'm doing the forms, God is happy with my worship. We can't hide behind the correct forms. The correct forms don't make us have correct function. There must be correct function, which is, again, our spirit connecting with God. Worship, true worship, has to be inside out, or it's not worship at all. By the very definition of the word, it cannot be worship unless your heart is engaged. It cannot be. In Mark chapter 7, verses 1 through 5, the Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating foods with hands that were defiled. Wrong form here. Read wrong form. That is unwashed. So the Pharisees and the teachers of the law asked Jesus, "Why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with defiled hands? Why are your guys doing this thing wrong?" They did not say a prayer before they ate their appetizers. Right? I mean, this thing is some wrong forms here today. Notice how the religious leaders are super appalled that Jesus didn't require his disciples to keep their traditions. Well, don't ever forget, this is a principle we need to learn this morning. That truth trumps tradition. Truth is more important than tradition. The tradition is just a form, a way of carrying out the truth, right? There was this Episcopal church, this is years ago, upstate New York, and it had the same rector who was over it for like 35 years. And he had this habit of touching the radiator before administering the cup during communion. Every time he would touch the radiator before the communion. And people began to think, that's like an important part of the communion because he does it every time we do it. And what he was really doing was discharging static electricity so it didn't shock people. But they didn't know that. So it kind of lovingly began to be called the Church of the Holy Radiator. And I know that's a ludicrous example. But if you think we aren't without our sort of ludicrous traditions from time to time, you're wrong, right? We're not immune to that. Traditions get started for good reasons, with right causes. They're not bad forms at all. But in the end, they can get mixed up with practical obedience to the living God. We can get wrapped up in what worship sounds like or looks like or feels like. But what is God concerned with? What is God concerned with? Jesus goes on, he replied, he said, "Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, you hypocrites. As it's written, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules. They worship me in vain." Now, why would Jesus say that? Particularly about the Pharisees, if you think about it. You talk about people who did everything right. Were they doing things they weren't supposed to do, or were maybe not doing things they were told to do? No, they were doing the right things, performing the required acts, but their hearts were not in it. Right acts with right heart equals worship. Right acts with wrong heart, not worship, right? Which brings us to our second truth, our final truth. That real rules regulations. Real worship rules regulated worship. God is perfectly capable of legislating exactly what he wants done. God is perfectly capable. Go back and read the books of Leviticus and Numbers, especially. God is perfectly capable. I mean, you go through the book of Leviticus, for instance, and it goes through exactly what worship was supposed to look like. I'm going to tell you exactly what animal, exactly what kind of animal, not just like I want a dove, but this is the kind of dove that I want. Not just a sheep, this is the kind of sheep I want. Not just a goat, not just a bull. I'm going to tell you exactly what kind of I want, how old this animal should be, exactly when you should bring it, why you should bring it, what you should do when you bring it, and the priest. I'm going to tell the priest exactly what he should do it, exactly how he should kill the animal, exactly how he should cut the animal up, exactly what animals, parts of the animal are going to go on to the altar, what parts are going to be burned up, what parts are going to be cast off, what you're going to be doing while all this is going on. I'm going to tell you what happens while that's going on. I'm going to tell you what happens after that's going on. I'm going to tell you what time of the year, what feasts, what festivals. I'm going to regulate your year. I'm going to regulate your day. I'm going to regulate your month. I'm going to regulate your life. God is perfectly capable of doing that, right? And he never does that for the New Testament church. Never does it. I mean, it's so bizarre that God can perfectly spell out exactly what he wants, and then he comes to us, and he never does that. I mean, you can go all the way through the New Testament. There is no order of worship. We don't even have an example of a full assembly. What happened? Not one. Oh, there are hints. There are a read between the lines. There's never a thou shalt meet twice upon the first day of the week and once upon a midday, preferably after everybody gets off work. We don't have any of that. We're not given what an example of what a single worship gathering looks like. It is in entirety. In fact, we're told that the Jewish believers came and watched the Gentile believers worship, and they thought, this is so weird, this is so different, this is not even worship. They're not worshiping the same God. This cannot be right because it's so different from what we do. There was that much difference, that much freedom among believers. Does it strike anyone as odd that after the way God legislated every detail precisely under the old law, that there's so much difference under the new law that people don't even know if that's okay? Can you do it that differently than us? I mean, that's just bizarre. And this is under apostolic leadership, right? This is a church that Paul planted. Paul, who came up with a Jewish background. I mean, you would think there would at least be some similarities, but apparently not enough for the Jewish believers. And so instead, what we have in the New Testament of exact spelling out, we have hints, there are examples, there are implications, there are inferences, but nothing at all resembling what God legislated under the old law. Nothing like that. Because why? God's primary concern is with our response to Him. Look, how you get that accomplished, that's going to vary from place to place and time to time, person to person. But this is what I want. Now, if you don't leave, you can leave here like you don't get anything else this morning. I want you to get like the next 2 minutes because I have zero interest in changing our external forms of worship. How we do things or the order we do things or the details about that, I'm not interested in that at all. Do I think that there are times that my preferences are different than everybody else's preferences? Probably so, right? We're all different. But I have zero interest in changing those forms. The way that we pray or sing or take or give the Lord's Supper, the preaching probably could use some work. But after that, I don't know. There's nothing else I'm really concerned with. No interest in making a dramatic shift in our forms of worship, nor do I have a desire to look at someone else's forms of worship, some church down the road or up the street, and say, this is what's wrong with the way they do it. Look, I am not their God. I don't get to judge another man's servant. So how they do that, that is for God to judge. I'm going to leave that one to God. That is reserved for His wisdom and His word alone. But I have every interest in spurring us, the Forest Mill Church, on toward powerful, deep, true worship. That is what we're looking for. True worship, not changed forms. We are looking for true worship, for us to be able to walk outside the doors a changed people because we have encountered the living God and that we are changed because of it, right? That we have come into contact with the living God, that we have come before His throne, that we have put ourselves in right relationship with Him, bowing before His throne. And let's be clear that the God of the heavens and earth doesn't need that from us. He's not up there thinking, oh man, I'm having a really bad day. Sure do wish someone would worship me. Oh, thankfully, there's this Forest Mill Church. You guys really pick me up. God doesn't get down and need in the blues and need us to pick Him up. God's not up there thinking, oh, I'm not really a very good God. Oh, they're singing what a great God I am. Now I feel better. Right? God doesn't need, He is completely self-sufficient. You know what God needs from you and me? Nothing. God doesn't need nothing from us. And that's terrible English. God doesn't need anything from us. But it turns out we need something from God. Like when God calls us to worship, it's not for His benefit. It's for ours. Like we, as beings created in His image, to be living in relationship with Him, we were made to come into this posture, this attitude of worship to Him. A few years ago, you may remember the story, there were these two whales. They were off Point Barrow, Alaska. And they were completely icebound. And they were battered, and they were bloody. They were gasping for air at this one hole in the ice. And their only hope was somehow to be transported 5 miles further out past this ice pack to open sea. And so rescuers began digging these, or cutting these string of breathing holes about 20 yards apart along in this 6-inch thick ice. They just began cutting these. And for the next 8 days, they had to coax these whales from one hole to the next, mile after mile, in frigid conditions, you might say. And along the way, one of the trio of these whales, these three whales, presumably vanished, presumed dead. But finally, with the help of a Russian icebreaking ship, the whales, Putu and Siku, they swam to freedom. Two out of the three, pretty great. In a way, I want you to think about worship as a sort of string of breathing holes in our ice-bound weeks. Worship ought to be the time we breathe true air, like the air of reality. When we come before the throne of God, we breathe Him in, and we're able to keep going for a few moments more. We come to Him battered and bruised in a world frozen over with greed and selfishness and hatred. We rise for air in the atmosphere of worship. We breathe again. We're loved. We're encouraged until the time that the Lord returns and forever shatters all the ice. We get that moment of air. But we look for that day when He removes every barrier, when we dwell continuously in the reality of His presence. Until that day, I pray that we'll continue taking advantage of, encouraging one another in this time of worship. And if we can pray for you this morning, if we can encourage you, we want you to know that this is another opportunity that you have to take advantage of this congregation. Let us serve you. Let us walk with you. Let us pray for you. Let us be your brothers and sisters. And if we can do that for you now, won't you come as we stand and as we sing?